Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Christina Phillips. I'm a producer for The Exchange. A note on the show you're about to hear. This discussion was recorded live at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, November 13th, before the start of the first public congressional hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. While we mostly talk about the logistics of an impeachment inquiry, we may occasionally refer to ongoing events on Capitol Hill. Thanks for listening.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, the House Intelligence Committee holds the first public hearings on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Two top diplomatic officials will testify on what they know about the charges against the president that Mr. Trump withheld foreign aid to Ukraine, unless that country's president investigated the Biden family's Ukrainian business dealings. It's a dramatic moment in our history, but since it all began, many questions have been raised about the process itself, and lots of misinformation has been put forward. So today in The Exchange, we go back to basics, what the Constitution says about impeachment, how this has played out in the past, and how much that might inform our current understanding. And let's hear from you. If you're uncertain about what some of the key terms are, or who the main actors are supposed to be, or what each phase of this process means, send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, John Grabe, professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, director of the school's Warren B. Ruggman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. And John, welcome back. It's always fun to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us in a few moments will be Dan Cassino, political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He's also featured in our Civics 101 podcast on impeachment. So, John, first, what are some of the most common myths or misunderstandings that you hear about impeachment?
Well, I think the principal one is that impeachment itself leads to removal from office. I think we use impeachment as shorthand for the process by which certain public officials can be removed from office. But of course, impeachment is just step one in that process. Step two, if somebody is impeached, is that the matter then goes to the Senate for a trial. And it's only if two-thirds of the Senate votes for impeachment that somebody is removed from office. And in fact, we have never in our history had anybody who is an elected public official impeached and removed from office. The only officials impeached and removed from office have been federal judges.
So that's the biggest misunderstanding, John. People think impeachment means, you know, day one is impeachment, day two, you're out.
That's right.
Well, in fact, we got several questions from our listeners on that. Jan asked, what are the chances Trump will be impeached? The House seems likely to say there is enough evidence for impeachment, but the actual impeachment takes place in the GOP majority Senate. In this decisive landscape, Jan asks, what are the odds Republicans will break from Mitch McConnell and actually impeach? Now, setting aside the politics for a moment, John, because legal is your area of specialty. She says, we'll actually impeach. It's the House that impeaches, right? The Senate acts more as the deciders, so to speak.
That's right.
Not the impeachers.
That's right. At the end of, you know, these public hearings are starting today in front of the House Intelligence Committee. Once these hearings conclude, and there also have been other committees conducting hearings and investigations into this, everything will go to the Judiciary Committee of the House, and the Judiciary Committee of the House will make recommendations on articles of impeachment. That is what the House then will vote on. And if a majority of the members of the House vote on one or more article of impeachment, that then would move this whole process to the Senate.
What are some of the other misunderstandings that you've heard floating around, John?
Well, I think some people, you know, because the impeachment and removal process does resemble a trial. I mean, there are analogs to be drawn to grand jury investigations, which precede indictments, which precede criminal trials. I think that sometimes people believe that processes and rules that apply in the trial context also apply in the impeachment context. But that's not so. Impeachment is fundamentally a political process. It's a political event. It's different from the criminal trial context. And yet, I think some of the similarities lead to, you know, we've recently, for example, seen in the news claims that it's a violation of the president's Sixth Amendment rights that, you know, to confront witnesses against you. And that is a right that's written into the Sixth Amendment. But that, you know, the hearings that have been held so far, which have not permitted the president to, you know, or the president's lawyer to confront witnesses and cross-examine them, that somehow that's been a constitutional violation. Well, the Sixth Amendment applies in the criminal trial context, which takes place under the auspices of the judicial branch, the third branch. This is different. This is a political process.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's been on TV a lot saying the president's rights have been violated. He has the right to confront his accuser under the Sixth Amendment. You're saying no, impeachment is a different animal.
Yeah, I don't think any, you know, serious scholar really accepts that argument. There was, you know, there was actually one scholar who put a paper out suggesting that there was something to that argument, but it hasn't been received enthusiastically in the scholarly community.
Well, and again, there've been a lot of statements, some of them true, some of them not true, some of them sort of fuzzy, that have been put out there since this whole process began. And I really welcome you, our listeners, to join us with your questions and comments. You can post on Facebook. You can tweet us. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your questions about the process and some of the information and misinformation that's been put out there. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, John, earlier I read a question from Jan. She has another one. Can you explain exactly how impeachment proceedings work at the Senate level? Do senators get to vote in private? If it's a public vote, I'm afraid that few Republican senators will have the guts to stand against McConnell and the GOP machine, Jan says. So, can you just explain this process, what the Senate does? Because we've gotten a lot of questions from listeners about the Senate role.
Sure. You know, the Constitution itself doesn't say a whole lot. I mean,
oh,
the Constitution
okay.
itself, the text of the Constitution, in fact, says that the Senate shall have the sole power to try impeachments. But beyond that, it's really been up to the Senate to develop its own procedures for how to conduct impeachments. And the Senate has done so. There are standing rules for how they will conduct, you know, an impeachment trial in the Senate. Historically, senators have not voted privately or by secret ballot. Their votes have been public. I don't see anything in the Constitution that would preclude them from moving to a secret ballot. And there have been some articles written in recent days saying, you know, that all it would take would be a few Republicans to join with the Democrats if the Democrats wanted it to be a secret ballot, and that perhaps that would, you know, free senators up a little bit from political pressures. I don't expect that to happen. So it will likely be a public vote in the Senate. But the Senate sets its own procedures. And the judiciary has made very clear that it's not going to second guess how the Senate does things. And a principal reason for that is that impeachment applies to federal judges as well. Impeachment is the way in which corrupt judges can be removed from office. And so the Supreme Court has said, you know, given that, we don't think we should really be involved in saying how impeachment should be done. We think that should be left under the political question doctrine, you know, to the Senate itself.
So that's super interesting, John. So the Constitution talks about the House's role in impeachment, but and we'll get to that in a second because mm-hmm. it's a big role. But in terms of the Senate, it kind of says, up to you?
Well, even with respect to the House's role, the Constitution itself doesn't say that much. I mean, the Constitution says that the House shall have the sole power of impeachment, and then it says the Senate shall have the sole power to try impeachments. And it, in addition to that, it says that impeachment should be reserved for treason and bribery and high crimes and misdemeanors. But beyond that, you know, and this is often the case, though, with constitutional law, the Constitution states a few abstract principles. And then over time, you know, we have elaborated on those principles, both through the political process itself and in some cases through court cases, which interpret and generate constitutional law.
Well, interesting. And we've got another question about the Senate's role from Tom in Exeter, who says, great show. Is it possible for the Senate to have an impeachment conviction vote by secret ballot? This this would eliminate the pressure to toe the party line. So, Tom, I hope we just answered that, that basically the Senate can do what it wants.
I think that's right. I mean, again, you know, there isn't much history here, but as I understand it, nothing would preclude the Senate from adopting a secret ballot if that's what it chose to do.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. So from what I understand, John, impeachment is rare, but it happens. Impeachment and removal from office is rarer still. So just give us the details on that.
Sure. There have been 19 impeachments in our history. Okay. There have been, and most of those impeachments have been of federal judges. Famously, however, though, two of those impeachments have been of United States presidents, Andrew Johnson in the 19th century, and then Bill Clinton, which, you know, many of us are old enough to remember that impeachment. So there have been 19 impeachments. There have only been 8 convictions and removals from office through the Senate, although a few officials also, after being impeached, decided at that point to resign, and the Senate didn't proceed with removal from office. But again, as I mentioned before, no elected official has ever been impeached and then removed from office by the Senate. It's only been federal judges who have suffered that, you know, that sanction.
So, speaking of federal judges, I just want you to give us this little historical note, John, because New Hampshire, first in the nation once again. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I guess the researchers this morning turned up the picture of John Pickering, who was a federal judge from New Hampshire, who was the first person who was impeached and removed from office. And he was impeached and removed for drunkenness on the bench and profanity and otherwise not conducting himself with the decorum of a federal judge. But that was a period that was easily as partisanly divided as we are today, too. And so there's a really interesting story. I won't get into the weeds about the politics of the early 18th century and impeachment of federal judges.
Well, and thanks to the team at Civics 101 here at NHPR for turning up that little factoid for me this morning. That's really interesting. The first person to be impeached and removed from office happened to be a judge from New Hampshire. Let's go back to our listeners, John, and Lori's calling from Jackson. Hi, Lori, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hello. And thank you for the show. I have a question about whether the House has the authority to demand that the White House turn over the full transcript of that phone call on July 25th between President Trump and President Zelensky. I'm wondering why we haven't had an opportunity to see or hear the full transcript.
Lori, this is a great question because there has been a lot of back and forth about you need to give us these documents or make this person appear, and the executive branch says, no, no, we don't. So go ahead. Thank you, Lori.
Yeah, I mean, I will return to the basic fact that this is a political process. The House, it's always been understood that Congress has, concomitant to the impeachment power, has the power to conduct investigations, and one of the principal tools of conducting investigations is subpoenas. The White House, through this whole process, has taken a blanket approach of saying no, you know, to requests for information from House investigators. Those who have given testimony already have actually done so in defiance of White House orders that executive branch officials should not cooperate with the inquiry. Ultimately, this issue may manifest itself in a court decision about the scope of something known as executive privilege, because that is ultimately the basis that that the executive branch seems to be relying on. There's also, beyond executive privilege, there's also claims of absolute immunity, but they kind of blend into one another. But the idea is that the Constitution provides some protection for the president to have confidential conversations with his or her advisors that need to be kept confidential. The Supreme Court has recognized that there is an executive privilege doctrine, but that it's qualified. This was in the case involving the Watergate tapes that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in the decision that ordered the tapes be turned over, did recognize a doctrine of executive privilege. I will say that the scope of the privilege being claimed right now goes far beyond what the Supreme Court said in 1974 or recognized in 1974 to be the scope of executive privilege. Even in 1974, while recognizing that there is an executive privilege, the Supreme Court said, however, on the other side, when there's a criminal investigation into the executive branch, the interest in turning up evidence of a crime outweighs the president's interest in keeping information private. And so we'll see. There are cases right now in court where judges are going to be asked to weigh in on this question of what the president and the executive branch need to do in terms of cooperating with Congress.
Okay, so Lori, it's a question that is still out there, I guess. And Rob has a similar question. Why hasn't anyone been arrested during this impeachment investigation for failing to respond to Congress's subpoenas? Rob says, if I'm ever subpoenaed for anything, let alone something as weighty as an impeachment investigation, and don't show, will I be left alone? So feels like a double standard to Rob.
Yeah, I mean, but again, it's a political process. And so those in charge of the inquiry have obviously made the calculation that, arresting somebody for failure to comply with a subpoena right now is not in their political interest. And, they'd rather sort of await some court rulings on this. And I will say that, the courts have been pretty uniformly in with respect to, the president obviously has been under investigation on a number of fronts since he took office. And there are a number of inquiries that are taking place, in different courts. And, the courts have not been kind to President Trump, at least the lower courts, in terms of validating some of his claims of executive prerogative, I guess I'll call it, in different areas with respect to these investigations and proceedings.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Watergate, because as you said, John, the Constitution doesn't give us a whole lot to go on with this, but people have been drawing from past examples, especially with these three presidential impeachments, although recognizing Nixon's didn't go all the way. Let's talk a little bit about what we can learn from these past examples. And I want to play a little bit from a news clip from PBS. This is announcing the beginning of the Watergate hearings coverage in May 1973.
From Washington, NPAC brings you gavel-to-gavel videotape coverage of today's hearings by the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities.
Good evening from Washington. In a few moments, we're going to bring you the entire proceedings in the first day of the Senate Watergate hearings. Hearings to bear the truth about the wide range of illegal, unethical, or improper activities, established or still merely alleged, surrounding the re-election of President Nixon last year.
Again, that's from May 1973 from PBS. So let's just talk briefly about Nixon, John, because that's been another point of confusion. A lot of people say Nixon was impeached. Not quite.
No, that's right. He actually resigned. It was clear that he was going to be impeached apparently also removed from office by the Senate. And so that message was delivered to him and he chose to resign before the process played itself out. And then, of course, they didn't proceed with impeachment. The other power that the Senate has actually, in addition to the automatic removal from office that takes place if there's a two-thirds vote, the Senate can also, in its discretion, bar somebody who's been impeached from ever again holding office, a position of public trust under the United States. So when Nixon resigned, that did not categorically end the proceedings. It didn't moot them like it would, in a court case. I mean, they could have gone ahead. They famously didn't. President Ford, who succeeded President Nixon, then, of course, pardoned President Nixon. So he didn't face any, criminal sanctions, criminal investigations into what he'd done. Because also, that's another point worth pointing out, is that impeachment and removal from office doesn't bar you then from also being criminally prosecuted for anything that also might have been a crime.
I see. So that's why Ford pardoned Nixon, just to basically clear the decks and say, you've had enough problems, you can go home.
That's right. Very controversially, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. I remember, sort of. Coming up, great questions from our listeners. Keep them coming in. We're talking about the ins and outs of the process itself, trying to clear up some of the misunderstandings out there. We're also looking at what the Constitution says. We will take a lot more of your questions after a short break, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
So Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, understanding impeachment, what the Constitution says about this, what certain terms really mean, and what we can learn from past examples. Overall, this hour, we're just trying to clear up some of the many misunderstandings and misinformation surrounding this process, and we hope you keep sending us your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, John Graby. He's a professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, director of the school's Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. And joining us now on the line is Dan Cassino, political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He's also featured in our Civics 101 podcast on impeachment. And Dan Cassino, a big welcome to The Exchange. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Laura.
Well, we talked earlier, but I'd love to hear from you, Dan. What are some of the most common just misunderstandings that people have about impeachment? For example, John said the number one misunderstanding he hears is that people think impeachment step one, you're out of office step two, that impeachment and out of office are the same thing.
I think there's a real big confusion about exactly what the process is. We treat impeachment like a judicial process, especially the removal step, because the Chief Justice is in charge of it. So we say, boy, this is like a trial, when of course the removal trial in the Senate is actually not like a trial in any sort of way a real trial would happen. In fact, the only reason the Chief Justice is in charge of it at all is because the normal person who presides over the Senate is supposed to be the Vice President. And of course, you wouldn't want the Vice President to preside over the Senate's impeachment trial because he's the one who would benefit if the President were removed. So this is not like a trial. People talk about the House representatives filing charges and bringing that to the Senate for a trial, but this is an entirely political process. And when you get to that trial, removal trial in the Senate, it really is up to the Senate to decide what all the rules are. The rules of evidence, for instance, don't apply. The president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has been talking a lot about attorney-client privilege. But, of course, that's a judicial rule. It doesn't apply to any of this. So all of these rules we're very familiar with, the Sixth Amendment, attorney-client privilege, all these things we've learned from watching Law and Order for years and years, none of these actually apply. The Senate can have whatever rules it wants. This is a completely political process and not at all a judicial one.
You know, I hear you, and I have heard public officials making similar statements. You know, it's understandable, Dan, that the average person who, you know, watches Law and Order and thinks, why don't these normal rules apply? But why do you think there's so much confusion among members of Congress about what's allowed and what isn't, what's okay and what isn't under this impeachment process?
Well, I think, first off, some of that is strategic. I think there are a lot of members of Congress who actually do know better, but would like to present the process as being unfair because it's not following the norms of a judicial process. That said, also, remember, our last time we had an impeachment process was more than 20 years ago. So members of Congress are not necessarily more up on this than members of the public are. They're not constitutional lawyers for the most part. They don't know how this is supposed to work. Also, remember, the impeachment process at all stages is shaped by the people doing it in the moment. All the rules we have are rules that were basically improvised, either in the impeachment of Andrew Johnson or the attempted impeachment of Richard Nixon or the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Members of Congress simply made up these rules in the past with very little guidance from the Constitution. So if you want to change the rules now, you can talk about what rules you'd want, and maybe you'll get your way.
Wow, yeah, and John Graby pointed that out earlier, that there actually isn't a whole lot of language in the Constitution that people have been kind of adapting as they go along. I have to say, John, I find that a little concerning, maybe, or maybe that's okay. The Constitution is a flexible document and it changes with the times. I guess I'm surprised that the founders didn't say more on something as fundamentally important as impeachment.
Well, you know, the Constitution was a product of compromise, and sometimes the only thing that both sides can agree to is something that you say at a high level of abstraction, like we're committed to due process of law, we're committed to equal protection of the laws. We're committed to, you know, freedom of speech, and they agree to then have that, you know, the meanings of those various phrases worked out over time. I mean, the impeachment process is similar. I mean, there is, you know, there is some language in there. I mean, we know for certain that the House does the impeachment part and that the Senate does the trial and removal part. And we do have constitutional language about what constitutes grounds of impeachment, treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. But, you know, yeah, beyond that, as is typical in constitutional law, it really is precedent and tradition that builds up the body of that which is constitutional law.
Well, and Dan, just to let you know, before the break in the early part of the show, we talked a lot about what the Senate's role is. We got a lot of questions from listeners curious about what senators are supposed to do. I'd like to dial it back to the House, Dan, with you, if I could. Who sort of initiates this whole process of impeachment, Dan?
Well, it actually depends on which impeachment process we're talking about. So in this process, it has really been the Speaker of the House and moving it forward, in this case, with the Intelligence Committee. In the past, it's always been the Judiciary Committee that did this. But it is going to be some committee, and again, it's totally up to the Speaker of the House, who's going to put forward articles of impeachment. And those articles of impeachment amount, if we're making the metaphor to a judicial process, those are the charges against the president. And then the House of Representatives is going to vote on those charges. And if they pass, then those are going to go up to the Senate. Now, we should also note that if there's more than one article of impeachment, so this happened with Andrew Johnson, for instance. Johnson was impeached on a number of charges. When those went to the Senate can choose to have one trial for all the charges, or as they did in the trial of Andrew Johnson, have multiple trials. So impeach him, so he's impeached on one thing, great, we're going to bring Andrew Johnson up on that one article, have a trial in the Senate, have a vote, and then Johnson was acquitted, so then they had another trial, and he got acquitted again. They can do this as many times as they have articles of impeachment. Those articles of impeachment are really the kicker. They're what is telling the Senate why the person should be put on trial, and the committee that puts them together is going to be the most powerful committee in this process. Again, that normally has been the Judiciary Committee, but in this case, we're looking at intelligence because of the classified nature of some of the material.
And that is the committee that is taking up the hearings today. So just to be clear, Dan, in Congress, anyone can bring articles of impeachment, representative, U.S. senator, and so forth. Is that correct?
Well, it's actually really interesting. So when you look at the Nixon impeachment or the attempted impeachment of Richard Nixon, it was actually the Senate that held the initial hearings. So those hearings, you played the clip earlier from 1973 of PBS airing those gavel-to-gavel hearings, that was Senate investigation, and it actually didn't go to the House until much later. So impeachment investigations is part of the oversight function of Congress. That can start anywhere in Congress, anywhere they're doing oversight. But the actual impeachment itself, traditionally, those articles of impeachment have come out of the Judiciary Committee.
So the official articles have to come out of the House, typically the Judiciary Committee, Dan.
Exactly.
And then what happens? The judiciary does its investigation, and then what?
Well, and then we're going to have a vote. The entire floor of the House of Representatives is going to have a vote on these articles of impeachment. If any of those articles of impeachment pass, they are going to be sent over to the Senate. In the Senate, this comes under a privileged motion. We've gotten a lot of questions about this in the past. The idea is, well, the Senate, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, doesn't actually have to hear things. If he doesn't want to calendar a bill or he doesn't want to calendar a motion, doesn't want anyone to talk about it, well, then the bill is effectively dead. And you can't actually do that with articles of impeachment. They come under what's called a privileged motion, which means that any member of the Senate can bring it up at any time, and they basically have to suspend all other business until they deal with that. Now, that said, that has been the precedent in the past, and of course, the Senate can change the precedent whenever they want, and they could change the rules and decide maybe it's not privileged anymore. And if that were the case, Mitch McConnell would never even have to hear the articles of impeachment, and there would be no impeachment trial whatsoever.
Wow. So as you and John Grabe have been saying, there's a lot of flexibility for members of Congress to shape this however they want, Dan.
Absolutely. And even if Mitch McConnell wanted to, you could even just dismiss the whole thing with a majority vote once they did bring it up. Now, Mitch McConnell has said he believes he has to go ahead and actually have a trial and have a serious trial. And I think that's a political decision. It would look bad, especially for members who might be in electoral trouble, if they don't seem to take this seriously. But certainly it's within Mitch McConnell's powers to dispose of this immediately if he wanted to.
So to some of us, it feels like this process has been going on for a long time. We've heard so much news about it. Where are we now in this process, Dan? You've been talking about the steps that anyone in Congress can take and that the House under the Constitution has to take. Where are we now in this seemingly long process?
Well, I got to say, this process actually, in the terms of American government, this process is actually pretty short. So last time we had an impeachment process in the House of Representatives with Bill Clinton, it started about the same time this one started with the where we got in late fall, we started to have an impeachment investigation. And it actually ended in February. So in terms of American government, it takes us more time than that to pass a budget. So this isn't actually that long. We're still kind of at the start of it. So we expect there's going to be hearings this week and next week, public hearings, and then there's going to be the articles of impeachment written up. That'll probably take a couple weeks, and then you're going to have a vote on it. I imagine the House of Representatives is going to have their vote or try and have their vote before the Christmas break. So within the next 6 weeks, we expect they're going to have a vote in the House of Representatives, and then you're going to have a trial when the Senate comes back next year.
Lots of questions from our listeners just about some of the language they've heard and about how this is supposed to work. And again, the message I'm getting from the two of you is there is some flexibility. David writes, excellent program on the topic of, quote, arresting witnesses who have defied the committee's subpoenas. Why does the answer to this always seem to focus on what the courts have ruled on enforcement of compulsory process? David says, I was under the impression that Congress has the inherent power to detain and hold a person who fails to appear in order to compel that person's testimony. In other words, David says, it is not a police action subject to court review, but an action undertaken by the House Sergeant at Arms and based on the inherent powers of the House of Representatives. David asks, is that incorrect? And I'll throw that to you, John.
No, my understanding is that's correct. But again, as Dan suggests, this is a political process, and the individual decisions that are being made along the way are political. It seems as though the leaders of the inquiry in the House have made the calculation, the political calculation, that actually proceeding to the drastic step of arresting and holding in contempt people who have not shown up would not be in their political interest right now.
Here's another question. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
Just logistically, I mean, the Sergeant-at-Arms is a person. He has a ceremonial mace. You're going to send a guy with a mace over to arrest someone, and, I mean, in theory, there's a place they can hold them at a cell in the basement of the House of Representatives. I mean, just logistically, it's going to be very hard to do that, especially since the federal law enforcement power, the FBI, all that, is under the executive branch. Right. What happens if the president says, no, don't let them arrest him? At that point, we've got an even bigger constitutional crisis. I don't think anyone wants to go in for that.
Wow. Okay. Well, another question. Here's one from Chris. A couple of guests have said this is a political process, not a judicial process. Can you explain what that exactly means? And Dan, that was you, so go ahead.
Yeah, so it means that all the rules we have for judicial processes don't actually apply. So there is no such thing as the presumption of innocence. There's no such thing as a jury of your peers. There's no such thing as a judge. I mean, even if we think of the removal as a trial, it's bizarre to think that in this trial, the jury, the Senate, can overrule what the judge says. So the judge says, well, this person can testify. The Senate can overrule them and say, no, no, they can't. So the jury in this case is setting all of the rules. So there are no set rules. There's no set procedures. Basically, the Senate can run this trial however they want. Also, so again, there's no impartial judge in charge of it. There's no rules of evidence. Everyone can set the rules as they go along. Now, they're going to try and set rules that at least look fair. But all of this is up for grabs. There's no right necessarily to cross-examine witnesses. There's no right to call your own witnesses. None of these things we think of as being the bedrock of judicial process actually apply.
Wow. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, Dan's absolutely right. In a criminal trial, you know, in a proceeding under the auspices of the judiciary, the judge tells the jury what the law is. The jurors swear an oath to follow that law. You know, it's debated whether or not jurors can engage in the act of nullification and choose not to follow the law and acquit someone. But it's understood, and it is the case in the overwhelming majority of cases, that jurors, if they believe the case has been proved, will return a conviction. But as Dan suggests, there's absolutely no similar understanding that those who are, you know, most analogous to jurors, the senators, are under an obligation to return a conviction if the evidence, you know, makes out, if the evidence is such that it makes out a case of a high crime or misdemeanor.
So again, just to reiterate what both of you have been saying, whenever people pull out something that they think, you know, should work in a regular court of law, this is not a regular court of law, so the usual rules do not apply. We're under a whole new set of rules here, set out vaguely by the framers.
Well, and just to add on what John was saying, part of the reason that jury nullification or saying we're not going to follow the law isn't really an issue here is because the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors is not really a legal term in the United States. I mean, this is a term from 18th century and 17th century British law that's never well defined because, of course, the British don't have a constitution. They didn't have to write it down. It's just from judicial rulings. So there's an open question. You know, it's not like a murder where it's very clear when a murder has been committed. It's not clear under the law what a high crime or misdemeanor is. This is a phrase that was added in the constitution basically at the last minute without a whole lot of debate over it. The previous term was maladministration in the earlier drafts. So there is open debate about what actually constitutes a high crime or a high misdemeanor.
Well, Chris, thank you for the question. Here's another one from David and Keene, who says it's a basic tenet in our system that someone accused of misdeeds normally gets to face the accuser in court with the identity of the whistleblower being kept secret. How does this work? John, you addressed this earlier, but go ahead if you can answer David's question again. The idea that supposedly, under the Sixth Amendment, someone has the right to confront their accuser.
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, the analogy to court proceedings, you know, inherent in that argument is strained even on its own terms because, before court proceedings occur, there are grand jury proceedings. Grand juries determine whether or not to return an indictment, which is a charge against someone, and then the trial proceeds. There is absolutely no Sixth Amendment right in the grand jury process to confront witnesses against you. In fact, the grand jury process features just the prosecutor talking to grand jurors to secure the indictment.
You know, earlier, Dan, you talked about how normally it's the House Judiciary Committee that takes control of this. But again, the House Intelligence Committee is taking first crack at this because of the sensitive foreign relations aspects of the questions before us. I want to ask you about something else that caught a lot of play in the news, and there was some confusion around what the rules really say, Dan. And that's the idea of secret hearings versus public hearings. So can you just shed some light on that? Because some Republican senators were pretty upset that some of these initial fact-finding hearings, if I could call them that, by the House Intelligence Committee were conducted in secret. So go ahead.
Yeah, so there was a big problem that Republicans had with these hearings, that not all members of the House of Representatives were actually allowed to be in these hearings. And the idea is that there are the House Intelligence Committee has certain rules about what can and cannot be let out. So they were actually holding these hearings in an SCIF, so a secure compartmentalized facility. So where secrets could not get out. So if there wasn't, it was classified, there was only going to be people in there who was going to hear it. And, of course, you had members of Congress saying, hey, we want to be part of this too. And so they, in fact, stormed the SCIF, which is a huge deal. It's a potential breach of security. But it seems like there wasn't anything too contentious or too secret in those hearings because, of course, we have now got the transcripts of almost all of those things. So the Intelligence Committee and a few other committees do get access to sensitive information. And so members of other committees don't get that. And largely that's because members of Congress really like to leak. They like to talk to the press, and they're going to leak sensitive information. And so there's a fear that if you let every member of Congress in there, they're going to leak the sensitive information. And that's why a lot of members of Congress weren't initially allowed in there. Of course, now the transcript has been released, and, of course, almost all those witnesses are going to be coming out for public hearings. So that concern, I think, has been kind of mooted.
Okay, well, Republicans are pretty upset about that. Let's heading into the break. We'll play a little bit from Alabama, Republican Representative Mo Brooks.
The American people deserve a public and open process. Bear in mind the significance of what we're talking about here today. We are a republic, close to a million.
Okay, so we seem to be having a little bit of problem with that audio, but that was Republican Mo Brooks talking about how upset he was that these hearings were held in private. And as we'll talk about after a short break, the hearings are now going public. We'll talk about the reasoning behind that. Also, some of the terms and language that we might expect to hear in those hearings. We will talk about that in just a moment. You can continue sending us your questions. We really appreciate you just jumping in with your basic questions about the fundamentals of this process. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
NHPR offers a lot of very valuable original reporting.
Ken Hill of Moultonborough talks about why he joined NHPR's Leadership Circle.
The fact that we can turn it on any time of day and listen to something worthwhile, not only about national affairs, but also about local affairs in New Hampshire, more than repays us for the contribution we make.
You too can support original reporting when you invest $100 a month or $1,200 a year as a Leadership Circle member at nhpr.org/leaders.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, how's the presidential contest going in Iowa? It's a different type of race in the Hawkeye State. We'll find out more. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. This hour, we're answering your questions on the impeachment process, what the Constitution says, and how this has played out in the past. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out this hour, John Grabe. He's a professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and director of the Rudman Center there. Dan Cassino's on the line, political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were talking about how some Republicans were pretty upset that the House Intelligence Committee began its process in secret. Republican members of the committee were allowed in, but not Republican members of the U.S. House in general. I was trying to play some audio from Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, really protesting what he called the secretive nature of the hearings. Let's hear.
The American people deserve a public and open process. Bear in mind the significance of what we're talking about here today. We are a republic. Close to 1 million Americans have fought in wars, beginning with the Revolutionary War, to give us the rights to control our own destiny. And what the Socialist Democrats seek to do today is to thwart, to disregard, to repudiate the votes of 60 million Americans in the 2016 elections. By golly, if they're going to do it in public. Don't hide it from the American people. Show your face where we can all see the travesty that you are trying to foist on America and the degradation of our republic that you are engaged in. We demand open proceedings. The American people deserve nothing less.
Again, that is Mo Brooks from Alabama, Republican representative. And Dan Cassino, as you said earlier, it makes sense that Intelligence Committee hearings would be held in secret when there's sensitive information. That's what you said earlier. But now we are going public, so maybe it wasn't that sensitive to begin with. How are we supposed to interpret that, Dan?
Well, you're absolutely right that it turns out that most of the information that was released, that was talked about in closed hearings, can be released. We know we have the transcripts of almost all of it now. We should note in some of those places, things were removed from those transcripts. Maybe there's certain things that we shouldn't be talking about here, that they decide they shouldn't be talking about open session. But it does seem like they were able to do most of it in open session. And that's probably a good thing. And Democrats, I think, are making a strategic choice here. They don't actually have to do these open hearings, but they make a strategic choice that they think they can move public opinion. Because, of course, impeachment always does come down as a political process to public opinion. And they believe by holding open hearings and getting sound bites out there and video and audio clips of the witnesses, that will influence the public more than these sort of written transcripts that we've seen so far.
Well, and speaking of that, here's a leader in this whole process, California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, announcing public hearings in a press conference. This audio is from the Washington Post.
It will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
Okay, so again, that's Adam Schiff sort of deciding to make these hearings public. And as you said, Dan, probably getting some public relations benefit from that. Getting back to what we have learned so far about this process, trying to clear up some of the misunderstandings out there and what we can learn from the past. We got a note from Jen who says, Clinton was impeached, but he stayed president. Can a president be forced from office? How is this impeachment different from the others? And if he can't be forced out, there's really no bite to impeachment. Why bother? Jen, thank you. To the first question, John Grabe, how is this impeachment different from others? You and Dan have both said each impeachment is a little bit different.
Well, you know, focusing on the, you know, the Clinton impeachment, one difference is that the Clinton impeachment followed an investigation by an independent counsel. That was the Kenneth Starr and the, you know, famously the Starr report at the end of it. There has been no independent counsel. Actually, the independent counsel law expired about 20 years ago and hasn't been renewed. So that's one way in which this impeachment is different. And Jen's questions asked, you know, can a president be removed from office? And the answer is yes. Bill Clinton was impeached, but the Senate did not vote to remove him from office. That requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate, and that didn't happen on the articles of impeachment that were taken up by the Senate. But if two-thirds of senators vote to remove an official who's been impeached from office, removal then happens automatically.
Well, and that gets to Jan's second question, and I'll throw it to you, Dan. If he can't be forced out, there's really no bite to impeachment. Why bother? And it doesn't seem like the Senate is going to vote to convict, to throw President Trump out. So what about Jan's question, Dan? Why bother?
You know, this is a question we are getting a lot these days, and say, boy, there's 53 Republicans in the Senate. There's no way they're going to vote to remove him. So what are we even doing? I would point out that in the Nixon hearings, so you had 51 days of hearings aired gavel to gavel on PBS. 71% of the public watched at least some of those hearings. And those hearings really did hurt President Nixon's approval numbers. Now, they didn't fall off a cliff until the smoking gun tape came out. But when the smoking gun tape came out, we saw Nixon's public approval drop dramatically. It was drops, I think, about 15 points in a week. And if that were to happen to President Trump right now, I have no doubt that the Republican Senate would throw him under the bus really quickly. Remember, politicians, members of Congress, members of the Senate, are trying very hard to get reelected. If once they decide, they make the calculation that, boy, we want to get rid of President Trump because he is a weight on our reelection, if they reach that decision, they're going to vote to remove him or do as they did with Nixon, go to him and say, you need to resign. So it is entirely possible. I know things seem very stable right now, but that can change very, very quickly, as we saw with Richard Nixon. And these hearings are part of that, Democrats' attempt to shape public opinion. At the end of the day, this is all about who shapes public opinion. And the real question about what is different about this impeachment hearing, the question is whether public opinion can still be shaped in the way that it was back in the 1970s, or if a media environment now insulates people so much from objective fact, if they're just now living their own media bubbles where they're only hearing people they agree with, if it's even possible for those sort of big shifts in public opinion to happen.
Interesting. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I agree with everything Dan just said, and I would add to it that, you know, even if the Senate chooses not to remove him from office, which many people are predicting, there still is the ultimate remedy under the Constitution, which is the next election. And so the impeachment process, now going public as it is, will serve to educate the people. And, you know, if the people don't like what the elected representatives are doing or have done, in connection with what has happened under this administration, 2020 is, less than a year away.
Right
now.
Around the corner.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to be talking tomorrow in the exchange about the Iowa caucuses and how that is shaping out. So, but you mentioned Nixon, Dan, and how the impeachment process hurt him, hurt Republican prospects. The other political example, though, that's coming up a lot is the Bill Clinton example and how the impeachment proceedings against him kind of backfired against Republicans. And some Democrats are saying, whoa, this could happen to us. So, you know, it can kind of cut both ways.
Absolutely. So after Bill Clinton was impeached, there was the week afterwards, his approval rating dropped a bit. And then the weeks after that, it started to climb. So his approval rating at the end of the impeachment process is actually higher than at the beginning of the impeachment process. But I think that was a very different sort of set of facts. And the reason it's very different is that this really was about a personal relationship. And so when Republicans first got, so Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House at the time, got the Starr report, they had no idea what was in it. And they'd pinned their hopes. They wanted to impeach Bill Clinton. And the Starr report, they read it, and they immediately were just dismayed that this is all there was. But they felt like they had to push forward with impeachment. The Republican members of the House just really wanted to get rid of Bill Clinton. They thought the public would be on their side if they did it. So they pushed forward, even though public opinion was not anywhere near as much in favor of impeachment of Bill Clinton as is right now in the impeachment of President Trump. So public opinion for Bill Clinton, support for impeachment of Bill Clinton, never really got above about 38-39%. And we're already seeing about 50% of the public thinks that President Trump should be impeached. So pushing forward in that case with an unpopular impeachment wound up helping Democrats and helping Bill Clinton in particular. But even then, I think that's a little bit of a misremembrance of what happened. Because what happened after that, yes, when Al Gore ran for office in 2000, he made sure to distance himself from Bill Clinton as much as possible. When the eventual winner of the presidential election in 2000, George Bush, ran, he talked about having to restore honor and faith and decency to the White House, again, in contrast to Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton didn't come out of this unscathed, and the Democrats certainly didn't come out of the impeachment of Bill Clinton unscathed.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so got another political question for you, Dan, and then another legal question for you, John. Dan, Matt writes, when the Senate does not convict, what will Democrats be saying? Matt, thank you so much.
All right. So what Democrats are going to be, so we're assuming that the Senate's not going to vote to convict. Again, we don't know that, and these things can change very quickly. But what are Democrats' messaging about this is going to be that President Trump was corrupt and should have been removed from office, but Republican senators were not willing to stand up, or they were too cowed by President Trump or too scared of voters to do what was right. So they're going to keep on talking about this as an issue. President Trump will, of course, say he's vindicated, that this proves he did nothing wrong, and they'll be fighting over this in the 2020 election. But the mere fact that we are now going to spend the next several months talking just about impeachment, talking just about what President Trump may or may not have done wrong, that is a good thing for Democrats. If I'm a Democrat and I'm running for office, I like the fact we're going to spend this time talking about President Trump and bad things President Trump did, rather than giving President Trump the chance to attack Democrats.
And here's a question from Mike. Are the people testifying under oath, and are there penalties? I'm not 100% sure what he means by penalties, but probably penalties for deciding not to testify under oath, or penalties for things that you might say under oath. Mike, thank you for the question. John.
Yes, they will be sworn in, and if they tell lies, I mean, if you lie to Congress, that is, among other things, a crime.
Okay. So they will be sworn in when they testify. They cannot say anything that is false because there will be penalties for that.
Well, there are penalties. Yeah, I don't know if I would say they cannot say anything that is false, but lurking in the background is contempt of Congress and false statements, which is a federal statute that bans making false statements in official proceedings.
Interesting. Dan, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, John's absolutely right. So it is illegal. The problem is that law has to be enforced, in this case, by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who is a Trump appointee. So the Justice Department or the U.S. Attorney for D.C. can simply say, yeah, we're not going to prosecute that. Congress, all they can do with perjury or with someone not showing up is recommend charges. It is up to the U.S. Attorney for D.C. to file those charges, and that is a political appointment job. So it seems unlikely that the individual who is the Attorney for D.C. actually would follow through with any perjury charges.
Okay, let's take one more call. Tom is joining us in Portsmouth. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Laura. It's Tom. I just wanted to bring up a frustration that I've heard a lot on news this week about elections being the ultimate decider when this president is accused of trying to rig an election. So depending on an election to resolve the issue seems worrisome to me, especially since if one attempt has been made to rig the election, if it's true, there's probably a lot more attempts being made that we don't know about.
Okay. And Tom, I'm going to set your question aside just for the moment, because we're going to do a whole show on election security and so forth. So I'm going to set it aside for now, but thank you very much for calling in. And a couple last questions for both of you. And John, to you first, let's say you can jump into a time machine, have a brief chat with our nation's founders. I'll give you just 15 minutes with that illustrious group. What would you ask them about impeachment? If you had the chance to say, what did you guys mean by this?
Well, I think, to the extent that their intentions should matter, and that's a deeply contested issue, actually, in constitutional law. But, we could ask for some elaboration of really what they mean or what they meant when they adopted the term and took it from English law, high crimes and misdemeanors. You know, I think the one thing, if I were given that opportunity to talk with the framers, the one thing that I would like to bring up is something I would bring up in a number of contexts of constitutional law, and it's the fact that the framers really didn't anticipate the political party system and partisanship being what it is. The system, was designed to disperse power. You know, we talk about separation of powers, and the assumption was that, for example, members of Congress would be most loyal to the institution that they belong to, which is Congress. And so you would expect that if the executive branch, as is happening right now, just in a wholesale way said, we are not going to cooperate with Congress, the expectation of the framers, I think, would be that members of Congress would rise to the occasion and protect their institution.
Loyalties to Congress first.
Loyalties to our constitutional structures and institutions. And, you know, at a time of bitter partisanship like this, and this is not an unprecedented, occurrence in our history, that's not what happens. The loyalties run first and foremost to political parties.
You said you'd like to ask them about high crimes and misdemeanors, and that's put out there a lot. Treason and bribery, though, John, those are also impeachable offenses, correct?
That's right. And just in recent days, you're seeing more and more indications that the House is going to be relying on bribery because the whole, the quid pro quo here quite arguably falls within the concept of bribery as it was understood at the time of the framing, which is that, I will abuse my office by doing something or not doing something in exchange for some personal favor.
How about to you, Dan? You've got 15 minutes with the founders. What do you ask them?
Boy, I'd really like to hear their thoughts on enforcement mechanisms, because we have this constitutional structure where the president and Congress are fighting, and the question is, who gets to decide who wins? Now, we oftentimes say, well, the courts should probably decide, but of course, that's not something the founders came up with, and the courts generally have been reticent to weigh in on these things, citing what they call the political questions doctrine, which is a way of saying, if the House, the Senate, and the president are fighting, we're going to stay out of it, because there's no way we're going to upset everyone by coming and weighing in. So I'd really like to know what the founders thought about enforcement mechanisms. What do you do when you're a president who just doesn't do what Congress asks, doesn't produce witnesses, doesn't come along, doesn't produce documents? What is the enforcement mechanism they envision to try and make sure that happened?
Interesting. So real quick, Dan, to you first, what are you going to be listening for as a scholar who follows this when these hearings begin? What in particular will make your ears perk up?
So what we really need to hear for this impeachment to go forward, for it really to have any chance of the Senate removing President Trump, is a direct connection between President Trump and the alleged crimes. Someone saying President Trump did this, rather than having indirectly, or as we've seen so far in the impeachment hearings, people saying, well, I was aware there was a quid pro quo, without anyone actually saying this is where that awareness came from. That's what I'm going to be listening for.
How about you, John?
I'm going to be focused on whether a story is being told, or whether what we're watching is what we so often see during congressional hearings, which is a series of grandstanding speeches by politicians. I don't think this is going to get any traction unless a story emerges that people watching can follow and can understand.
Okay. John, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
John Grabe, professor at UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, director of the school's Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. Dan Cassino, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
That's Dan Cassino, political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He's also featured in our Civics 101 podcast on impeachment. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.